gestern waren die Tiere vor allem vorbeigekommen, heute die Pflanze. Und ich bin auch froh, dass wir heute Kollege Frau Maria Fink bereit gefunden haben, auch teilzunehmen an dieser Tagung. Sie ist für uns hier die Hochschullehrerin für ökologische Pflanzenschutz. Und das geht nicht ohne einen Blick in die Genetik und in die Züchtung. Und das ist auch so eine Sache, die sehr stark von Maria auch hier unterstützt wird. Wie geht es hier mit der Pflanzenzüchtung weiter? Und das kommt selbstverständlich auch in Ihrem Vortrag nach vorne. Maria, es freut mich, dass du das mitmachen wirst. Mhm. Gerne.
Ja. Ja. I'm going to give my presentation in English, simply so that the people who don't speak German can follow. But I did make my presentation in German, so I hope that everybody can follow in the end. Yeah, I'm a plant pathologist, but actually I wanted to become a breeder once I understood what genetic diversity is and what we need it for. And that's a long process of a long history of myself, and this is why I'm standing here. And I'm very happy, for example, that Eva is here, because one of the main interests I have is in understanding more about the genetics behind, and I'm really by training a population geneticist and a population biologist first. And based on this, I'm a pathologist and very interested in breeding. And I have to say, another student who studied with the same professor I did, she is now the professor for plant breeding in the University of München. We all both came from Oregon State University working with Chris Mundt, who works on diversification strategies. Das ist, glaube ich, dusselig. And I have to do it like this. So, now you get a little bit. When Ton asked me to give this presentation, it was like, is there an ideal type of a plant? And I immediately got antagonistic, because I have worked so long time with plant pathology, and I'm so strongly convinced that what is done in breeding for the last 100 years, and which is very much pushed by the conventional breeding industry, which means uniformity and the ideotype, and this is where we have to go, and this is the one real thing, is simply wrong. And I am very much convinced that we have to look much more into diversity and into how to use diversity in a good way. That doesn't mean we have to use chaos. And that doesn't mean that we shouldn't do anything to make the plants the way we like them. But we have to try to work with nature instead of against nature. And I think you trying to have uniform plant stands that everybody is the same is against nature. And it's going to always cause disaster. And so really, I put a second title here, Biodiversity for the Tasks of the Future. For the challenges of the future, maybe would be the better translation. I want to talk first about why biodiversity and what kind of biodiversity do we want or need. Then I want to give a few examples how biodiversity affects, can have effects in the agricultural system. And of course, I talk more about the effects that we want. There are also unwanted effects. And this is one reason why we are breeding and why we are influencing agriculture. Otherwise, we could just take what we have out there, but obviously we would starve. Then I want to talk a little bit how breeding for biodiversity could happen, and how it could also contribute to maintain biodiversity. And I want to give a concrete example of the modern land race concept with an example of the wheat composite crosses we are working with, and give a few words about the legal and problems that ensue from that, and where I think we should be much more active working with. Of course, I didn't invent all this. If we look at this quote from 1942, that was only 12, 14 years after people started using hybrids, by the wide use of hybrid corn, meaning maize, we are depriving this important crop of its power of taking care of itself, and by continued crossing and variation, continually adjusting itself to the equally variable parasites which attack it. That was Neal Stephens, the big plant breeder of the United States, where the textbooks still carry his name, just like the botany textbooks here carry the name Strasburger. And Stephens very soon recognized, it was only 15, 20 years after E.C. Stackman had understood that plant pathogens make races and adapt. And so there's a whole row of people who worked in this topic, and I'll talk about that. If we think about what Stephen said here, he really talks about adaptation processes. And what we need to know, and I'm going to talk as a pathologist to you, and so you will have examples from the disease side, that whenever you increase the size of a plant population, you also increase the potential size of a pathogen population. And that means you increase the amount of inoculum that is produced. So the more uniform the plant, the more uniform will be the pathogen population, the larger will be the pathogen population, the larger will be the inoculum pressure. The larger the population, the more likely you will have mutations, because there's a certain number of mutations happening, and the more potential for recombination is happening. That means the variability on the pathogen side will also increase. Genetically uniform host populations cannot adapt themselves well to pathogen populations, because where there is uniformity, there you have very little potential for adaptation. Luckily, we have epigenetics, so maybe there's still some hope. Now, just to give you an idea about the history of people talking about the problems I'm talking about, I'm not new in this. So Stackman in 1947 wrote that plant diseases are shifting enemies. Once we breed resistance for this disease, all of a sudden, the beautiful green leaf area is taken over by another pathogen. And so this other pathogen didn't play a role, because it was outcompeted by a more severe pathogen. Once the resistance is there, others come in. We know this in many systems. We know it in apples. We get rid of apple scab. All of a sudden, we have fly speck fungus, which hasn't been a problem before so much. We know it in wheat, potatoes, whatever we talk about. Then in 1971, the spectacular disaster on the corn harvest in the United States, $1 billion went down the tubes within 3 weeks because of the Texas male sterility in the corn germplasm, which made all hybrid corn of the southeastern United States had the same mother plants or the same mother germplasm containing mitochondria that encoded the male sterility. So it was maternally inherited through the mitochondrial DNA, which was closely linked to the susceptibility to a pathogen, the southern corn leaf blight. And when the weather was right, the complete corn harvest of the southeastern United States went down the tubes within several weeks, in May or June, 1971. And from this, of course, came a few more stronger papers: genetics of disaster, diversify or be damned. And then Pat Mooney, who really has been very influential in my thinking, together with Kerry Fowler, later wrote a book, but he started with this very catchy title, Seeds of the Earth, a Public or Private Resource, where he showed how the in German, the book is called Saatmultis und Welthunger, and where he really showed how the agglomeration of the seed industry is really leading to more and more power in a few hands. Pathologists have been looking at things, and this is interesting because calling a disease epidemic a normal agricultural accident, this is by joining a sociologist with a pathologist. Lawrence Bush from Minnesota is a very interesting person, a sociologist, and showing that it's oftentimes our own fault that we have epidemics, because what we do in breeding is really asking for disaster. And then, of course, the big story about the Chinese farmers who learned to grow their rice in mixtures, and which was published in Nature, and they're doing several million hectares like that. And last but not least, last year, a whole group of scientists from Europe who had worked together in a European networking project, we sat down and said we have to put together what we had discussed in the 4 years of working together, and this is the article that came out, that we need to really change our thinking by embracing complexity through diversity at all levels. And there we really go in the whole, from the roots up to the leaves. So, very influential is this book, and I think it is worthwhile looking at it, because I think the English title is much better than the German title, giving the real contents of the book, and showing how food politics and the loss of genetic diversity work together. And this is Pat Mooney, and I don't know if anybody of you knows that this man has been blind since he's 13 years old, and he has done all this work. Well, almost. Huh? Yeah, but when he cannot read. Yeah, he does all by listening. So, but I want to go into what are we talking about. We are talking about genotype-environment interactions. We have talked about it yesterday, we'll talk about it today, so you'll see that a lot of things are related. What do we do in agriculture? Shall we try to reduce the environmental variations as much as possible, or should we be flexible in dealing with environmental variation? And those are the questions that were asked yesterday about the animals, and the same questions we are asking about plants, so we are very much related. If we look at them, how does agriculture deal with them in terms of plant production? We have soil, we have pathogens and pests, and we have climatic variation as some of the major variables. So conventional organic agriculture are not very much different in the way they deal with it. Basically, all talk about breeding wherever possible for adaptation, especially when it comes to climatic questions. In terms of how they can deal with it, the conventionals have more fertilizers available to equilibrate the soil conditions, and they of course have pesticides available that oftentimes make it possible, even if mistakes have been made, to still get a yield. While in organic agriculture, you have to work preventive, and then you may be able to use here and there a little bit something to reduce disease pressure, but normally we don't have pesticides available that really get rid of a pathogen. So we are much more depending on good prevention, meaning resistance, but also looking into the system. And that's what I'm going to talk about. When we talk diversity and genotype-environment interactions, diversity will buffer against pathogens, insects, and also weeds. But it can also protect plants from cold, heat, drought, from all these environmental variations. It has usually positive effects on reducing erosion. It stabilizes yields, and it can also affect quality. And I want to talk a little bit about this. And in this kind of diversity, I want to talk about it, because this is diversity that provides functionality in the system. And what we can do, if we understand how diversity works, we can improve the system in the way we want it. To improve always has, of course, a human connotation. What do we want? Improving in the general sense, we can question that. But as we are humans and we want to eat, this is what we are interested in. So I want to talk about how biodiversity can really affect the agricultural system, how it affects pests and pathogens, and I want to talk about some topics that are not so commonly known about the associated microorganisms with plants and about induced resistance and how those are also affected by diversity. Because the other things that we mix varieties with different resistances, this is well known that this will reduce disease pressure. But we have a lot more in this system. Then yield stability and a little bit about quality. Of course, when we have pathogens, they are not uniform in the field. This is a very typical picture of a late blight in potatoes. You have a few plants that haven't been much affected yet, a few that are almost dead. Over time, they will all go. But in general, you don't have a field uniformly diseased. You always have spots with more and less disease. And if we look at the effects on yields, for example, of pathogen and the effects on disease, it can be very interesting. Those are experiments I did years back looking at yellow rust and wheat. And if you look here, we had on top, we have the pure stands of several wheat varieties, and they differed in their resistance to yellow rust. So some of the pure stands had almost no disease, and some were highly susceptible, having 80 or 90% of the leaf below the flag leaf, the F-1 leaf, covered with yellow rust. And even though there were different varieties, we could compare, because we used fungicides in the system, the pure stands with or without fungicides, and we could see that the yield was relatively affected. And the more disease you had, the more yield reduction relative to the healthy control. When we grew these different varieties in mixtures, the first thing you see, we don't have any plots where we had this high amount of disease. That means the highest severities were cut out. If we mixed very susceptible varieties, then the severity stayed still relatively high in comparison to if we mixed healthier varieties. But what happened, while we have here a significant reduction of yield with increasing disease, with 72% of the variation in yield could be explained by disease. Here, I drew the same line here. This is the stippled line here. But and I then also asked the computer to make a regression line, but it's totally insignificant. That means we cannot say that the yield will really be reduced very much by the disease anymore. And this is due to compensation, because the healthier plants will do better and compensate in the yield losses. Now I want to talk a little bit about associated microorganisms, because this is new. The other stuff you probably all know already. Now, I'll use the example of soil fatigue with apples. We know that if we want to, we have the apple replant disease. If you have an apple plantation, you take out the apples after so many years and you want to start a new plantation, you can't. There's a lot of problems with the soil. We have problems with the fertility, and fertility really in the broad sense. We have pathogens in there, we have problems with micronutrients and toxins, and we don't know what. So what is typically done, you have to crop the soil a few years with some other plants, and then you may be able to come back with apples. So conventionally, of course, there's also fumigation happening to try to take out all the pathogens by chemicals. You fertilize. Ecologically, you fertilize and you put intercrops for one or several years. And Washington State has a lot of apple plantations who are looking at what can they do. And there's some very interesting results. Some basic information that we need to have is clear. And I put that here because I don't think it's clear to everybody that 30 to 50% of what the plant assimilates through photosynthesis is released through the roots into the soil. And that means the soil fertility is severely affected by the plants that grow there. And this, of course, explains the positive effects of rotation. And each genotype has its own spectrum of microorganisms that are attached to it. And I talk about each genotype, not each species. Within species, every genotype will be different. And I'll show some data. And this, of course, is affecting the microorganisms that are living in the soil and all the other, and all, as well, the positive microorganisms as also the damaging one, the pathogens. And this is just an example from work by Mark Mazzola from Washington State University, and I just took a few of the data from the paper, which is a huge table, and just showing three different biotypes of two biotypes of Pseudomonas pudida and one of Pseudomonas fluorescens. And what you see here is a control, which is empty soil where nothing has been grown. Then you have the variety Pinawawa grown in soil that has been sterilized at 95 degrees. And then you see a few other wheat varieties, including Pinawawa, grown in non-sterile field soil that was taken from an apple plantation. And you see, depending on variety and soil treatment, you have different percentage of the total population of the pseudomonads of the different types. So in the control soil, you see especially fluorescence, BioVar 3, but you see very little of that and nothing of that. And then you see here, for example, and lutejane is very strong on the biotype A, while Madsen is strong on P. fluorescens BioVar 3. So depending on variety and genotype, you have different things. So each variety has their own spectrum. And if you look at the whole table, it's really impressive. Now, what does that have to do with apple replant disease? What they did, they grew for several rounds in this soil wheat, always the different varieties, and then they looked how much Rhizoctonia solana infection do they get on the apples when they grow them in that soil where this wheat has grown after so much time. And so in the control soil where no wheat had been grown at all, they get around a little less than 20%. If they take the sterilized soil, the disease goes up very much. But then, interestingly, if they use lutejane or Pinawawa that was grown in the non-sterile soil, they get a significant reduction of Rhizoctonia solanae on the apples. So because these two varieties supported a different microbial community, which had a different effect on Rhizoctonia solanae, there was a suppression of Rhizoctonia solanae after these varieties, but not after the others. So they say these results demonstrate the importance of host genotype in modification of indigenous saprophytic microbial communities and suggest an important role for host genotype in the success of biological control. And we have other results from maize, from the Italian group or so. So this is not a singular result. The question that I'm asking is, how probable is it that we will have one single best wheat genotype to do the job for us? Because this is just Rhizoctonia solanae. Apples suffer of many different diseases. So I would suggest the best bet is use more than one variety in this whole game, and maybe even more than one species. Induced resistance, just to explain what is it. If an avirulent pathogen strain comes into contact with a plant and tries to enter this plant, there's resistance reactions are triggered. And the interesting thing is once these resistance reactions are triggered, they will also work against later coming virulent pathogen strains. And so it's basically a priming of the plants or almost like a vaccine of the plants against infection. We found out, though, that not each pathogen strain and not each will induce resistance on the same on all genotypes. So some genotypes may be induced in one way and some in another. And also, we have found out that the induced resistance doesn't work uniformly against all pathogen strains. All textbooks say induced resistance works against all pathogen strains. This is not really true. On our work on tomatoes, we showed in detail, and it's just published, that this is not the case. So the question is, I was asking these questions about 6 or 7 years back. Wouldn't it be an interesting breeding goal for organic breeders to breed for inducibility of resistance? Because I thought this would be great. We could grow plants that defend themselves. But what I found out during these years, thinking about this, reading, and also doing own work, is that the most important thing to get induced resistance is to have a diverse pathogen population. If we produce a host population that is genetically uniform, we'll produce a pathogen population which is genetically uniform, and this way we won't have much induced resistance. And there are some very beautiful results showing that. I'm not going into detail there. In more diverse plant populations, we have more diverse pathogen populations, and we have a more efficient induction of resistance than if we have uniform plant populations standing there. And I'm absolutely convinced that it is improbable that we'll find a single best inducible genotype that'll do the job. That we will, it might be a good idea to look, is it working? But it is difficult to identify induced resistance, and most likely, once we select one single best inducible genotype, the pathogen will adapt itself just like with any other mechanism. We also showed that it depends on how you grow your plants. We grew the tomatoes either with chemical fertilizer, with hornmeal organic fertilizer, or with two complex organic fertilizers, which have a lot of trace elements in them, not as simple as just hornmeal. And the disease we observed on the detached leaves of the tomatoes was significantly reduced with these two fertilizers in two experiments, but not when we, in comparison to the chemical. But the hornmeal also didn't reduce the disease in comparison to the chemical fertilizer. So we also worked with plant strengtheners, and we found a lot of plant strengtheners work very nicely. But again, the plant strengtheners may work on this variety, but not on that. So the question is, do we have to combine plant strengtheners? Do we have to combine them with the fertilizers? And we are just at the beginning of these questions. Variation is high, especially in organic agriculture. You have probably all seen pictures like that in nature. You see here a barley field, and you see here a fertility spot. If I need to look for pathogens to demonstrate, for disease to demonstrate to the students, of course I know where to look for it. I'll go look here. But, I mean, the plants should be able to deal with such a field. Maybe there was a mouse nest or something last year. And this is why the plants do better there. And if we now look, how do varieties behave in different environments? These are old data we collected in Poland in the 1980s and 90s. There they grew 7 barley varieties in a total of 7 environments. Those are different places in years. So we have Bankow, 89, 87, and 88, so 3 years in the same site, and Rajikov in 2 years, and Konchavikte in 2 years. And what I did, I took the mean yield in each environment, and then I put the highest yield on the right side and the lowest yielding environment on the left side. So in 1988, in Konchavikte, we had the lowest yield of these 7 environments, and in Bankow, the highest. But then Bankow in 89 was the 3rd lowest. So I just sorted them by yield. So, also, das war die Umwelt, wo der höchste Ertrag erzielt wurde, und das die Umwelt mit dem niedrigsten Ertrag. And then I just looked at the 7 varieties, and they were also growing all 7 varieties in mixtures of 3 varieties. That makes a total of 35 3-variety mixtures you can get. So we had a total of 42 treatments. And so I just ranked who had the highest yield in which environment. And I turned it around and said 42 is the highest yield and 1 is the lowest yield. So it looks nice on the plot because we always associate up here good and down here with bad. So and I'm picking out now the pure stands. And these pure stands, there's one that is relatively high, sometimes, like the blue one, that was Apex, it was almost the best yielder in these two environments. But it was almost the worst in that environment. And it was intermediate here, and rather low there, and intermediate there. In all the others, you can follow the lines, go really wild. Sometimes they're really good, sometimes they're bad, depending on year, depending on site. The only one that was very reliable was the one that I put in red, and it was reliably bad. So this is the reliability we do not really want. Now I looked at the best three-way mixtures over these, across all sites, and this is what it looks like for these. Those I took, I had seven pure stands. Here are the seven best three-way mixtures out of these pure stands. And what you see, that the low ranks are mostly missing. So in general, few of them were really the top. A few sometimes even had rank 42, which is the highest possible. But they were all jumping around. But in general, the mixtures didn't perform lowest. They may not be the best, but you never know which variety is the best in which year. You are more safe with mixtures oftentimes to get a more reliable yield. Mixtures can also affect quality, because if you have less disease, you usually have better quality. And there's this compensation effect, which I already showed, that the site-specific variation in soil or so can be compensated, because some genotypes may like this environment better, some the other, and if you mix them, like in cereals, and they are very nearby, you may have a lot of compensation. And even differences in product quality may be compensated, especially in cereals, of course, because you have many different types that you can mix. It may be a little bit different with apples. So if you have the site potential for baking volume, we worked in 8 different sites in 2003, which was a very extreme year, you may remember, very dry. And we only mixed 2 varieties. We mixed a high-quality variety, Arena, from Switzerland, with a rather productive variety, Capo, which fortunately is also rather drought-resistant because it comes from the dry areas of Austria. And we looked at the baking volume we could achieve with either the pure stand of Arena or the pure stand of Capo. And you see here the squares are Capo. The diamonds, the dark ones, are Arena. And the triangles are the mixture of the two. And then I looked, how does the baking volume relate to the potential of a site? So it's the same as I did with the yield before. I sorted the different sites by the mean baking volume. Ich habe einfach das mittlere Backvolumen, das an einem Ort erreicht wurde, hier auf der X-Achse aufgetragen. And so when you look at the regressions that I did, they were all significant. But you see, with Arena, 53% of the variation can be explained by the site potential, with Capo only 37%, and with the mixture 72%. That means the mixture reacts much more strongly to the site than the two others. That shows also that the slope of almost 1.5 means the better the site, the better the mixture will do in terms of baking volume. Arena, basically, the better the site, the better it will do. This is not really significantly different from one, while Capo will do better in not so good sites in comparison to good sites. So this is the interesting regression that you see here. Of course, if the site totally is bad, you don't get good baking volume, but you have more potential to get a maximum if you have more genotypes in that site. So overall, the potential of a site was better used up by the mixtures. Now, this is all very nice because those are mixtures of varieties we were using. Now, I come to the question I asked in the beginning, how can we breed for the biodiversity and with this also contribute to the maintenance of biodiversity. I want to first talk a little bit about what are the challenges of the future. What kind of strategies do we have for genetic resources in selection, and or could we use? And then I want to present how we could get functional diversity through the breeding process rather than to breed pure lines and mixing them together again. Of course, climate change is in everybody's mind. We will probably have warmer winters, we will have less frost in the soils, we may have many pathogens may survive better. We have a real problem, and I've talked to several farmers who say that because of the warmer winters, they are losing a lot of humus over the winter because there's a lot of mineralization going on. We have longer vegetation periods. We may have invasive species, and we have lots of them already. We have, of course, loss of species. We will have, overall, a massive increase of genotype-environment interactions. As simple as that. If we talk about plant protection, which is my field, I also talk about plant protection within the system. Of course, we need resistance and we need tolerance. But we also need to look at these beneficial microorganisms that I showed the examples with the wheat. How can we improve the association with these microorganisms to improve the system? How can we improve wheat suppression in the system instead of going in with energy-intensive methods of mechanical wheat control? And how we can we improve induced resistance in the system? Is that really useful to try to do in genetically uniform populations? And that's the question that I'm going after. And I showed already with the associated microorganisms and with the induced resistance that I do not believe that it will work in genetically uniform populations as well as it will in diverse populations. So these mixture results I showed, they are nice, but they also have problems. If we use mixtures or multilines, we have to remix them all the time. We have to first produce the pure lines so we can mix them in the end. That's very expensive. If we continue growing them year after year, they will change in their composition. And the question is, will they change the way we want them? And we have problems, legal problems sometimes. And we don't have real co-evolution because it's us who dictate which genotypes will be planted in which year. We don't let the plants evolve themselves in the system. If we breed for diversity, our aim is co-evolutionary processes and really to exploit genotype-environment interactions. So here you had read that before. I gave you all this. And here is the last sentence that I was taking out in the beginning. We have to always think that pathogens, insects, pests or so, will adapt themselves to their hosts. And we have to work against this adaptation by making the host also adaptable. So the host can adapt to their increase resistance or avoidance or whatever they do, just as well as the pathogens and the pests will always be able to adapt to the hosts. So we have to give back to our cultivated plants the plasticity, the freedom to change. So what do we need? We need a broad genetic basis. We need efficient methods to identify important properties that we also want uniform. That doesn't mean we just put anything in the field. We want a certain taste, we want a certain quality, we want a certain thing, so we try to have this uniform. But the rest doesn't have to be uniform. And then we have to use the right environment to do this selection. So which environment should we use? And how many? So here, organic agriculture, of course, has something to provide because we have higher variability in nutrients. We have higher variability also in pressure with pathogens and pests, and we have higher biodiversity in the system usually. Which genetic structure? We know and this is exactly what we heard yesterday, if we reduce environmental variation, this will increase the calculated heritability. Thinking about epigenetics, this means only that it may mean, in part at least, that some epigenetic processes simply are not started, because if the environment is uniform, the whole potential of the plants is not triggered. If we have more variable climate, it is absolutely questionable if it makes sense at all to breed in narrow environmental conditions. So, but if we have populations with functional diversity, with plasticity built in the populations, they can react better to variable environmental conditions. So, how can we do it? We can do what is called in English composite crosses, crossing together many lines and having a population then evolving. We can do top crosses, which is especially interesting when you talk about improving a whole population. If you have a diverse population and you want to maintain the diversity, which is done sometimes with land races. I have seen studies in millet of land races or so by Eva Welzin and co., where they use the whole land races, all its diversity, as a maternal line and pollinate with a uniform paternal line. So they bring new genetic material in a basis without eradicating the diversity that is available on the site, but they help to bring in new genes. Or that there's other approaches by simply giving a little bit of seed to the farmers who already have their own seed to mix together with their own so the stuff can interbreed. It has been done in beans in Africa quite a bit. So that can only function if we work together with farmers in a participatory approach. We cannot do this all on station in small plots. We just have to work together with the people who really grow the plants. And there's nice examples, the Simit wheat program in Nepal and India. They simply gave away small samples of seed to the farmers to improve the genetic basis, but making it impossible for people to just eat their own seed and use Simit seed. Yeah? You just can add a little bit of it. Yeah? Avoid that people get rid of their own seed because they think, oh, these great scientists are bringing in beautiful new seed. Just give them a little bit. So the people can experiment themselves. And the bean program in Rwanda was very successful at that. A new approach has then been the modern land race approach that has been developed by Steve Jones and Kevin Murphy in Washington State. This is very interesting because Steve Jones was very strongly rooted in the modern genetic approach to wheat breeding. He has become more and more an organic breeder. And it's really fascinating to follow his history. And why did he do that? Because he realized that farmers don't have their rights anymore. Farmers don't have access to their seed, and it doesn't make sense what's happening to just concentrate things. So they said land races seem to be very interesting in many properties, but still farmers are not very much interested in them, especially in the United States, in Europe or so. One reason is because farmers need to be able to work with machines. They need to be able to work, to have yields that are comparable. So you have to have some of these properties that are not in the old land races. And there is no point in maintaining like a museum an old land race. What we need is to take the positive properties of the old land races and transform them into our new modern material, because the breeders have had incredible success in the last 100 years, despite this uniformity track. So why not make use of the success of the past 100 years and combine it with the success of the land races? And there comes the idea, cross together our successful stuff, give it back to the farmers and have them evolve it on site for site-specific adaptation. We have in Europe a cooperation on a wheat composite cross that was started in the UK by Martin Wolf in 2000, where they used 20 varieties and crossed them together. And we have distributed them now in many different countries with a lot of collaborators. I got the populations in 2005, and now I have them in the F9. It's just going into the ground, so the F10 will be harvested next year. And we just let them go right now. We are hoping to get some money to do something real with it, but we have no money to work with it. It's just on the side. But in the F7, for example, you see still a lot of variability in these populations. Difference in color, height, leaf position, aunts or no aunts. So it's a highly diverse population, even after 7 generations. We also had very high variation, for example, in seed size, harvesting single plants and checking what's happening. So in one year, we had a very interesting one producing very big seed. The next year, we didn't find much. But I mean, if you harvest 50 single plants, you may or may not hit one of these. But that means there's potential to select for larger seed size or stuff like that. Another very interesting thing is, if you talk about wheat, you talk about an inbreeder. And everybody says, yeah, after a few years, you will simply have a mixture of lines that are genetically uniform. But most people don't know that outcrossing in wheat can be as high as 12%, depending on the population you look at. If you have a genetically uniform line, if there's outcrossing, you will have genetically uniform progeny, even if there's outcrossing, if everything is homozygous. But if you have a mixture, things will happen. And we went in the F5 and harvested single plants and took the seeds of these plants and inoculated them with different rust races. So what we have here is the progeny of one single plant. So all these pieces of leaves belong to one mother plant that has many different seeds. Plus a few controls. I think this one was a control and this one was a control that were susceptible, so we knew if our inoculation worked. And we inoculated all these leaves with one rust race. And what do you see here? This one is totally resistant, this one is a little bit susceptible, and this is highly susceptible. All coming from one parent in the F5 of an inbreeder. Yes. So, in the F5, you can do the calculations 50, 75, 87.5, 93. So, it should be about 97% uniform. And what we had in 22 out of 23 of these progenies that we tested, we had non-uniform. Only one of the progenies were genetically the same. They would behave the same, and we used 3 rust races. So, we had the potential for 8 different genotypes, and we found in many of these 8 different genotypes. And this is suggestive that a lot more outcrossing is still going on than people think. Just a picture of this. In the year 2009, we had high rust incidence. We had a control variety, Bussard, which is rather susceptible to rust, standing there. And Bussard is also one of the parents in there. And on the same date, taking the picture of adjacent plots, and it was assessed a few weeks before, but we had 40% rust on Bussard. We had only 15% in the composite cross. A very typical picture. You have quite a bit of disease reduction. But we are also playing with this stuff. This is the typical way we sow the stuff in wide rows, so we can use hoes, because we are not always safe with the weather, so we can use the harrow. So we want to be able to use different management system. But I said, I don't like this. I don't like the mechanical weed control all the time. Let's try something else. And so we did that also, just broadcast sowing. And if you look at it, this is the wide row. It looks nice and clean. I have a very good technician who is really taking care of our plots and keeps it nice and weed-free. And this is the broadcast without any weed control. So we simply suppress the weeds. Of course, you can't do that in a plot that is full of weeds and this is badly managed. You have to have a good rotation. But if you have a good rotation and you have a strong population, you may be able to get away with that. So I'm trying now to run this one population only this way and another copy of the population in the hoeing. And after a few years, I will compare. Are they different? So I'm putting selective pressure. So you could look for resistance to fusarium. You could, by adding infected fusarium straw into the plots, so you select for that. by selecting for larger seeds that are usually have less fusarium. You can look for competition. You can look for low input. I have them under organic and conventional conditions. I want to compare if there will be different in the way they deal with fertilizers in the end. Yield. Quality is a different issue. It's difficult to select for quality unless you can really do single seed stuff. But the people in France are doing the analysis now, and it will be very interesting to think about this. And then, of course, environmental variation. We even run these populations in cycles from one place to another every year. It switches place all through Europe. But we also have problems. That's the legal side. What are the consequences of this? We will never get this as a variety, of course. And the question is, why are these rules? Why do we have distinguishability, uniformity, and stability? Historically, it was very important, protecting the consumers, because the consumers were otherwise getting anything, and people would claim this is this or is that, and it's hard to test. But it has a lot to do with marketing and with patents in the end. Yeah? It has nothing to do with biology and our biological needs. So if I have a few thoughts about this, and I want to just put them forward. What about biodiversity and the future? First thing, the future will be more variable than we have it now, if we have this more unpredictability of the climate. We have one, the possibility, biodiversity is one option to deal with this variability, and it's an important option. Only if we use biodiversity, we can maintain it. We cannot put it in a seed bank and think, there we have it. We need the biodiversity to develop in the field and to constantly adapt. There is a lot of positive system properties that are connected with biodiversity. And you get them only, these positive properties, if you have a diversified system. Otherwise, they will disappear. We can only work and increase biodiversity if we work together with the stakeholders, which is, in most cases, the farmers. That means we need to go much more into a participatory breeding framework. So otherwise, we will always have only a few sites that we can afford to maintain as breeders. But only if we work with the farmers, we will have the variation that is real in the field. And we do have a problem with varietal protection currently, because, of course, I can work with my populations. I can make a memorandum of understanding for anybody of you who sits here, so I can give you the seed to grow. But you are not allowed to give them away as seed. And I know in the biodynamic sector, of course, there's a lot of ways that people try to work around this, but it's not really satisfactory. Yeah? And you can grow old land races and you get an exception from this, but why can we not do modern land races? And so there's a lot of activity now in the European level, and if you look at the Farm Seed Opportunities Project, which has been running for the last 3 years, finished last year, there's a lot of movement going on, and it's the German Development Agency is asking about it and doing a lot of workshops on this topic. How can we deal with higher diversity now? So there's a lot of interest coming. And so we should be very active in this. Of course, I'm not doing this alone, and I have a lot of very dedicated people helping here, and one is even sitting in the room. That's Maike, who has done her bachelor thesis and is just working on her master's thesis, just spent a few months in the UK with Martin Wolf. And very importantly, the people from France, Isabelle Goldranger and Julie Dawson, who came from the group of Steve Jones in Washington State and has been in France now for the last 3 years. Very important research they have been doing, showing a lot of basic properties of wheat there, including the mutation rates in wheat. They have shown that they are much higher than thought. Géza Kovács, who is the head of the gene bank in Hungary, who is doing a lot of breeding activities, a very active person, and many other colleagues from all over the place. Yeah, so much for that. Viertelstunde oder so noch. Ja. Ja.
Ja, wir haben noch. We have for about 15 minutes. We can ask questions. So.
Und natürlich auch auf Deutsch. Ich übersetze es dann schon.
Und sehr anregenden Vortrag, der mir vieles, was ich aus den Beobachtungen her eigentlich kenne, zu bestätigen scheint. Und es bestätigt auch meine These, dass wir eigentlich nicht als Züchter, einfach nur als Züchter in der Welt stehen können, sondern dass wir eben uns als Züchter auch in einem gesamten System denken müssen, aber auch eigentlich unseren Kunden das ganze System verkaufen, in Anführungszeichen. Also es bringt mir eigentlich nichts, wenn ich eine neue Apfelsorte entwickle, die ist super, die wird weltweit angebaut, weil sie so krankheitsresistent sind und ist, und nach einigen Jahren bin ich genau in der Falle, dass diese ganze Resistenz zusammengebrochen ist. Ich muss eigentlich als Züchter das Umweltsystem mit vermarkten, also versuchen, das auch rüberzubringen, damit sich das dann möglicherweise eben auch in Zukunft hält.
The important thing that breeders really are system scientists and really need to think about the whole system rather than just about one property. The question is there's also participatory approaches in Europe? Yes, there are a few. And it's very variable among countries. For example, Martin Wolf in the UK, they are rather successful. They have found a lot of people working now with the composite crosses, a lot of farmers. In France, there's actually a very strong movement of farmers, especially in the cereal breeding, because France is the home of UPOF, of the seed where the varietal protection started. And the UPOF organization is extremely powerful and also rude. And we had a workshop in France in 2006 that was organized by the National Institute for Agricultural Research. And 2 days before the workshop started, the people who organized it got a call from the highest administrator of INRA saying, "What are you doing here?" And but they were smart, they had been smart, they had invited the highest representative of UPOF to the workshop, who was also coming to a discussion. Yeah? So they had involved UPOF in the whole system. Otherwise, the workshop would have been cancelled. And there's a lot of French, the French farmers traditionally are very renitent people. And so there's actually a lot of independent breeding going on and development for French bread also, because the modern varieties don't make very good French bread because they don't deal very well with sourdough. And you get much better French bread if you use sourdough, but then you use different type of quality. The same with the durum wheat. To grow good durum wheat organically, you need totally different types of durum wheat, but if you want to have organic noodles, you need decent durum wheat. So that's why you have in Italy and in France quite a few people dealing with that. In US, Steve Jones, Washington State, they have quite a few people working with them, because there the farms are so big it's tradition that farmers buy maybe 10 to 20% of their seed only, and the rest is regrown. And if you have a farm of 10,000 hectares, it makes sense to do your own local selection system. But in Germany, most of the participatory breeding is going on from Bingenheim, Dreschflegel, and these little organizations more in the vegetable sector. And I think you, Karl-Josef Müller, you have some people collaborating, but they are more just growing stuff for you, right? Or you just get the fields from them.
No, Martin Timmermann tried to yeah. do a project about yeah. participatory plant breeding, but there was no interest or let's yeah. say, not enough interest from the farmers.
Yeah, it is very difficult. And I have now a few of my students have gone back into practical farming, so I hope to get some collaborators in the future.
In the Netherlands, the old colleagues of Louis Bocuse, they do potato breeding
yeah.
with the farmers.
There is a tradition.
It's a big tradition, yeah. and there is also a tradition with the wheat breeders. Yeah. So there is something on at the Louis Bocuse Institute.
And Dutch breeders in general have a tradition, but Eva yeah, and then Karl-Josef and then... With respect to insects, it has been shown, also in cereals, for example, that there is communication, and that if aphids come, that overall resistance goes up. With respect to pathogens, I don't think anybody has ever looked, but most likely, yes. Clearly, indirect communication in terms of if you grow varieties with different microbial communities next to each other, the roots are entangled, and so you will have effects. And we know, for example, if you use good compost or so with high in microbial activity, you have induced resistance in the plants. So how much of that comes now from some plant producing certain exudates and feeding certain microorganisms that then induce resistance again, or certain mycorrhiza or what have you? There is not very much hard knowledge. But the little we know about plant communication, there's no reason to think that it's not happening. Yeah.